Hey Trojans, and welcome back to General Education. I'm your host, Kevin Gramling. We have a lot to catch you up on, so let's get right into it. This episode contains references to sexual assault and violence. If you are in need of support, help is available. Check the description for more information. Former USC student and football cornerback Joshua J. Jackson Jr. was arrested and charged with raping three women, according to the Los Angeles County Police Department. In a statement announcing the charges Wednesday, District Attorney George Gascon ensured that everything would be done to hold the person responsible accountable. Jackson allegedly raped a USC student in March at her own on-campus apartment and a UCLA student at Jackson's own apartment. His bail is set at $1.4 million. The Los Angeles Police Department believes he may also be involved with unreported sexual assaults and is searching for additional victims. Jackson, who's 21 years old, appeared in 7 games in 2021. He didn't see any playing time as a redshirt sophomore in 2022, as his season was filled with injuries. He graduated from USC in May. Jackson is expected to be arraigned at the Fultz Criminal Justice Center in LA this week. The investigation is ongoing. President Carol Folt appointed Joel Curran as USC's new Senior Vice President and Chief Communications Officer. Curran will assume the position July 10th, taking over from Beth Schuster, who served in an interim position following Kyle Henley's resignation. Henley, who led communications at USC since March 2021, is now the Vice President for Marketing and Communication at Colorado State University. Curran has worked in communications leadership at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Notre Dame. He's also worked in leadership positions at public relations firms, including Kramer Krasselt and MSL Group. In her announcement, Folt expressed her excitement about Curran's hiring. She said Curran's unique toolkit equips him well to lead our talented team and connect with USC's key audiences across an evolving communications landscape. In other news, with Pride Month upon us, USC Student Health wants to highlight its range of gender-affirming care services. These services include hormone therapy and surgery, as well as counseling and mental health. In a briefing with the Daily Trojan, Chief Student Health Officer Dr. Sarah Van Orman emphasized the importance of investing in the training of health center staff on practices that create a safe space for LGBTQ+ individuals. Student Health's commitment to providing inclusive care recently earned it recognition, designated a Healthcare Equality Index leader by the Human Rights Council. The Healthcare Equality Index is a benchmarking tool that evaluates the policies and practices related to LGBTQ+ equity and inclusion of a healthcare facility. With gender-affirming care under attack across the nation, Van Orman said she recognizes how critical these services are. More and more students are using Student Health's gender care-related services, Van Orman said. She acknowledged that microaggressions against LGBTQ+ folks can happen in any healthcare environment. Student Health, she said, is committed to fostering a safe space for all students seeking medical help. At the first summer Senate meeting of the undergraduate student government on May 30th, senators debated the size of funding allocations for recognized student organizations. Senators will finalize the budget next week. Senators spent most of their time discussing how much money the Concerts Committee should get. Senator Brandon Tavakoli protested the $542,000 allocated to the Concerts Committee, arguing that amount is, in his words, unjustifiably high. Here is Tavakoli on the Concerts Committee budget allocation.
So for Welcome Back, if we look at their expenditures last year, right, one concert, all of the money that was spent on the paid headliners amounted to $98,000. That's 4.5% of the entire budget, both mandatory and discretionary. $98,000, 4.5%. So the expenditure for one concert, paid headliners, amounts to more than what we're allocating to all of our assemblies, including BSA, which has the highest allocation. So I don't believe that that is a good reflection of values.
Tavakoli went on to say the money would be better spent by RSOs. In response, Senator Emily Bletsas said concerts warrant the $500,000 being allocated. Necessary costs like concert security, she said, can't be cut. The debate then moved on to the best ways to spend the money allocated to the concert committee. One solution, proposed by Senator Juliana Melendez, was to focus the budget on getting well-known headliners to perform at USC, and then filling out the rest of the roster with student performers. And finally, a former Keck School of Medicine resident filed a case against USC, UCLA, and Los Angeles County on Thursday. Dr. Melanie Cargill alleges she was discriminated against on the basis of her race and disability. Breaking news writer Jennifer Nearer is with us to talk about the story and what it was like covering this breaking news. Okay, so now we can get into the article that we really want to focus on for this piece, which is yours on the lawsuit against the health center at USC. And is it also UCLA?
Yeah, so the suit is against it's against USC Keck specifically, not the health center. It's the USC Keck School, UCLA Health, and LA County. I believe specifically the LA County, like Office of Human Resources, or at least that's the sector of LA County that was kind of mentioned explicitly in the suit, although the actual lawsuit might go to LA County as a whole. But yeah, those are like the specific organizations within these three bodies that have gotten mentioned.
Among these specific bodies, or even Melanie Cargill herself, was there an attempt to get her as an interview or an interview with someone as a part of those three groups?
Yeah, so we reached out to, we reached out ideally to USC Keck via USC PR, as the Daily Trojan has that protocol. We reached out to UCLA Health through their comms line, and we reached out to Cargill's attorneys via a number that was made available from the city news service release that we obtained. And I left a voicemail with one of the attorneys who has yet to get back to me. UCLA Health also has yet to get back to me. And we got a statement from USC, not USC Keck specifically. We got a statement that we were asked to attribute to the university as a whole. And it was the same exact statement, almost if not entirely word for word, that the city news service had gotten a few hours before we received it.
So to move in specifically into the case, I'm aware that she's fairly active on social media, on TikTok and Twitter, from what I know from my own kind of research. Did you incorporate that into your research at all? Did you see that?
So yeah, one of the things I looked at was when I Googled Melanie Cargill to find, I think I was looking for either a photo of her or a way to contact her. And I stumbled across a TikTok actually that somebody else had made showcasing two tweets that Cargill had written. One about her experience in the operating room one time where she witnessed one of her supervisors doing something terrible to a patient while they were under anesthesia. That was like really hard to read for me. But she tweeted about that. And then the TikTok showed another tweet of hers where she said she had been terminated from her position within the program. And I went to her Twitter because I'd seen a link to her Twitter, and those tweets had all been taken down. The lawsuit mentioned that she was very vocal about her time in all of these programs and her complaints and vents about these programs and her supervisors on Twitter. And when I went onto her Twitter account, none of that was there. It was a lot of mostly retweeting other people's tweets about cycles of abuse, not letting abusers get to you, and her tweeting like little emojis that would indicate that she agreed with these tweets, but not a lot of her saying her own material. And so I got the sense that either for legal reasons or for whatever, she had scrubbed a lot of these tweets from her account. But I knew that given what was in the lawsuit and given the TikTok that I had seen, that she would be very active on social media. And even I think I found her Instagram account, but that had no posts since 2020, I believe. So either there had been posts that she deleted and I missed them because I got there too late, or she just hadn't been active on Instagram specifically for a while.
I see. So moving into like overall reporting on this case, what are some important things you think to keep in mind when reporting on it? Are there certain aspects of the story that you think we should or can be sensitive or mindful towards?
Absolutely. There were a lot of parts of this case that, like I said, for me were difficult to read just because some of the stuff that Cargill was alleging was so awful. I mean, the supervisors that were mentioned in this story were doing some really abhorrent things and saying some really abhorrent things about their colleagues, their residents and students, and even patients at these hospitals. And so first, what, you know, I think we as reporters have to be mindful of is not maybe dumping all of this info into the story that we write, not because we don't think people need to hear it, but because some of this stuff is just so awful that it's like you would have to spend the story we wrote was not incredibly long, but not the shortest brief I've ever written. I think if we included every single thing that was being written about in this suit, we would be spending far longer writing this story, and the story would be long, and it would be detail after detail of these awful, awful things that supervisors were saying. And this kind of goes into my next point. On one hand, we could be writing that. On the other hand, another thing we're dealing with is the fact that this is a lawsuit that has just been filed. I dislike saying this because I'm of the mindset that you should be believing people until they're proven wrong. But this is a lawsuit that has just been filed on the word of one, maybe more people. And it is Daily Trojan specifically, if not the protocol of multiple newspapers, to be very careful with the language you're using. I had a huge discussion with my editors about this, how we have to make sure we're saying the suit alleges this, not saying that anything explicitly happened. Because aside from the court documents, we didn't have a lot of evidence ourselves that these were happening, aside from the two tweets I saw in the TikTok and the lawsuit documents. And we also had a huge discussion over whether or not to mention doctors by name, even if they were mentioned in the suit, because it's something that we could be possibly held liable for if this turned out to not be true, or if someone wanted to come after us for defamation or something like that. This was even something we took to our legal advisor and asked, and were ultimately advised not to include the names of doctors explicitly. So it's a very odd balance, I think, is what I learned, between wanting to say absolutely everything that's going on here versus making sure that everything is supported in a way that is both saying what is being said happened and also protecting ourselves. Sounds a little selfish, but making sure that we're doing ourselves and the suit justice at the same time.
Right. And the suit is public information, so the reader could go and read it themselves and see, like, for the first account.
Yeah, it's right. Public information. We did have to pay to get the documents. Like, technically they're public, but they are behind a paywall, which doesn't make them necessarily more private. You know, anyone can go in, put in their credit card information and obtain these documents as long as you know the case number. But that is actually something we factored into our decision to not mention some doctors explicitly, the fact that we had to pay for the court documents in the first place in order to get them.
Okay, so moving forward, is it clear that if she's coming into the case with any hard evidence, has there been any mention made of that?
There is, at the very least, towards the end of the suit, it's mentioned that an email was sent out by LA County, I believe the Department of Human Resources, that was essentially slandering Dr. Cargill, and that email was not only sent out to a lot of people, but it was also posted on various official social media channels. I would imagine that's a piece of hard evidence that this suit has. I would seriously doubt someone would lie about that, because it's very easy to go, you know, verify that. So there's at least that email, which I would think would be a very good piece of hard evidence to have. As for any hard evidence pertaining to, like, stuff that doctors did or said, at this moment, I don't know. I would think that taking out your cell phone and recording stuff during an operating procedure is probably not going to have happened for a number of reasons. It's possible there was recording equipment in the operating room if this is a program that's teaching medical students. So perhaps there is recording somewhere of some of the stuff that one of the supervisors did during the operating room, as that's mentioned a lot. So I would be wrong if I said I doubt there's any hard evidence, because I very much think there is. The question is, how much?
You had two articles come out this week. What was that timeline like? Were you, like, bouncing back between the articles? Was one done way before the next one?
So I'm filling in this week as a breaking news writer. So I'm essentially on call. I was a breaking news writer first semester this past school year. So I'm back in that rhythm. I'm on call for this week. So on Tuesday, we had information about the lawsuit story come in. And that's when my editor, well, that's when Anjali reached out to me and was like, hey, can you cover this story? So I said, of course, you know, I'm the breaking writer. I'll do it. I looked into that. It ended up getting published the next morning only because we got it kind of late on Tuesday. And because I'm on the East Coast, like everything for me is automatically later than where our office is. So we published the next morning. So then the same night, we had this new news come in about Joel Curran being appointed Senior VP of Communications. So I ended up taking on the story. And that one was finished pretty quickly, actually. The editors only asked for like a really short brief and just to send out some emails to see if we could get anything back.
So as like breaking news writer, you have to be ready for those quick turnarounds that are like going to pop up. And by that night, by the next day, you need to have something
else. Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, I was a breaking news writer or one of the breaking news writers first semester. So I was already kind of used to the quick turnaround time. And I've definitely had stories that I get, you know, that morning as a breaking writer and I get them in by like 5 p.m. and the turnaround time is not that intense, I think, because I'm used to it. There have also been stories that come in way later in the day, but you still want to get them out before production. So the timeline's much shorter. And that's a little more intense. And it's still, if the story is short enough, it's not that bad. A lot of breaking news is these kind of very quick briefs, just like the one that we wrote yesterday about Curran. And it's not, you don't generally get interviews for breaking news stories. The most I think I usually get is a statement. I've gotten a few interviews for stories. And usually if I get asked to get an interview, I will get an extension, so to speak, on the story. Like if the interview is really important, the editors will be like, it's okay, we can release it like tomorrow or the next day. But if it's either a super important story or we don't get interviews, it'll be that night. And it's fine. Again, they're usually pretty short, so the turnaround isn't super intense.
That was really insightful. I'm glad we went to some places that honestly wasn't expecting. Thank you so much for coming in, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for General Education. This episode was hosted by Kevin Gramling, written by Kevin Gramling, edited by Thomas Johnson, produced by Grace Ingram and Christina Scarble. General Education is one of three shows on the Daily Trojan Podcast Network. You can find more episodes anywhere you listen to podcasts, as well as our website, dailytrojan.com. Visit the episode description for our links and more information. We hope you're enjoying your summer, Trojans, and we'll be back next week.